This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Welcome back to Dreamland. I'm Kelly Chase, guest hosting for Whitley Strieber. And today, we're diving into one of the deepest and most mysterious questions at the heart of the UFO phenomenon. What if this mystery is not just about visitors from other worlds, but about the very nature of death itself? Whitley's dearly departed wife, Ann Strieber, after reading thousands of communion letters from experiencers, famously said, "This has something to do with what we call the dead." That insight has only become more relevant as we begin to unravel the connections between UFO encounters, near-death experiences, altered states of consciousness, and ancient myths of the afterlife. Could it be that the beings that we call aliens are not from distant planets, but from a realm much closer, one that we eventually all enter? Joining me today is Joshua Cutchin, an author and researcher whose work challenges us to rethink everything we thought we knew about the paranormal. His book, Ecology of Souls, A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal, makes a compelling case that UFOs, fairies, cryptids, and even psychedelic experiences may be different facets of the same mystery, one rooted in the soul's journey beyond death. Josh was also featured in Cosmosis, UFOs and a New Reality, the docuseries I wrote and executive produced alongside director J. Christopher King. And speaking of Cosmosis, I'm excited to share that the UFO Rabbit Hole podcast has evolved into the new Cosmosis podcast, with Jay joining me as co-host. Cosmosis is where we push past the surface of UFO and paranormal discourse, exploring the mysteries of reality itself with an open but discerning mind. It's a space for deep conversations, groundbreaking research, and a re-examination of the narratives we've been given about this phenomenon. And in the first two episodes, we talked to experiencer Courtney LaFall, whose story touches on many of the themes that Josh and I discussed in this episode today, including the connection between the UFO phenomenon and the afterlife. I hope you'll check it out. Without further ado, here is my conversation with the brilliant Joshua Cutchin. Well, hi, Josh. Welcome to Dreamland. It's so great to see you. We haven't talked in a long time.
I know. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. You know, although it feels like I've seen you more recently since we were kind of on screen together for Cosmosis. And as we alluded to shortly before we hit the record button, I adore it. I am absolutely gobsmacked by how it came together, and it's exactly what we need right now. Even if I wasn't in it, I would still say those things. But just the idea that we're having media that moves immediately, or at least very quickly, past those initial questions of is this a thing or not, I think is really important as we continue to go through this time period, whatever it is, where these things are becoming more and more evident. What we need now is a closer interrogation of what these things could be, one that's also stripped of dogma, and that's just exactly the niche that I feel that Cosmosis slots into very well, while also, you know, spotlighting experiencers, which is what the entirety of the phenomenon is about. So just big slow clap for what y'all pulled together. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Josh. That means so much, especially coming from you. And we're already working on season two, and we'll definitely be hitting you up about that because we'd love to have you involved with that as well. So we'll have to talk about that offline, but I think you'll be excited about where season two is going. So,
all right.
Amazing. Well, I'm so excited to talk to you today and to dive into what has become really one of my absolute favorite books in the whole field, which is Ecology of Souls. Could you, for people who aren't familiar with your book, and hopefully they'll go out and buy it after this, could you give them a little summary of what is Ecology of Souls? Why is that the title of the book? What drove you to write this book, and sort of what is the core thesis?
Well, that should take us past the half hour mark.
Right? my work's done.
There are a couple of different approaches that I take when writing books. One of them is to, really sort of take a closer look at things that kind of make me a little bit uncomfortable, things I don't know what to do with or how to nest into my understanding of the phenomenon. One of the other things I like to do is to look at things that are mentioned in passing, but no one ever really does a deep dive into. You know, maybe it'll get the attention of a paragraph here and there in a book, but no one ever really dives into it. So that's pretty obvious with some of my older work, like The Brimstone Deceit and Smells, like really just doing a deep dive. And this thread of the UFO phenomenon having something to do with the dead has really been in the back of my mind for the better part of a decade at this point. You know, part of it was things that Whitley would say that he had observed that Anne had noted about, you know, this has something to do with what we call death. But also just some of the, what I would describe as the sort of transitive property. You know, a lot of my work does take a look at the UFO phenomenon as how it relates to fairy folklore. And if you go back way past the winged creatures and the wands and the, you know, the children's storybooks, you'll find very strong connections to the human dead. Dr. Simon Young, who's sort of a fairy scholar of mine that I really look up to, said that in a lot of, you know, pre-theosophical cultures, if you thought about the fairies, they were most often in the context of the dead. So if the UFO phenomenon resembles fairies and fairies have this connection to the dead, then what does that say about the phenomenon writ large? So I decided to write a small book about UFOs and death.
it's large.
That blossomed. Yeah, it's a, the finished product is about 260,000 words, basically broken into two because it was just too much to talk about. I quickly discovered that if I wanted to put the UFO phenomenon in dialogue with some of these older death traditions, I might end up, it became very apparent right off the bat that if I was going to put the UFO phenomenon in dialogue with some of these older traditions about death and some of these concepts like polypsychism and the wandering soul, that I could either have constant digressions and lose the thread, or I could just say, well, let's set all that up in a first book and then do a second book. The title Ecology of Souls is a direct reference to psychonaut Terence McKenna's speculation that once one sort of entered the DMT space, which again has tons of connections to the UFO phenomenon, that perhaps what we were entering is an ecology of souls where we are alongside the dead and our ancestors. So again, I thought that this was going to be, I didn't really think I could approach it lightly, but I didn't quite realize the scope of what this would become and how every aspect of the paranormal, which in which I lump UFOs, really does always seem to circle back to death and this sort of transition that we make between this world and the next, which is why it carries the subtitle A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal, because it seems to touch upon all these different topics, which I find equally interesting.
Something that I think a lot of people struggle with in terms of thinking about the UFO phenomenon with relation to souls or the afterlife or death is that this is so often presented to us through a materialist paradigm. And not just that, but like we're starting with the most physical part of it, which is the craft, which do, and beings, which do, we do seem to have some evidence that these things are at least sometimes physical. So can you talk a little bit about, there's a sort of idea of like afterlife technology that you talk about in the book that I find is really fascinating. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Certainly. And I understand that struggle because, you know, as I alluded to, like this is something that I was like, I don't know really what to do with this. So let's do a deep dive, Josh. I suppose the first thing to set up would be my strong suspicion that our current culture, modernity, whatever you want to call it, tends to think about physical and non-physical in this binary that is not quite accurate. You know, I ran into this a lot with one of my Bigfoot books, Where the Footprints End, people saying, oh, ghosts don't leave footprints. So how could Bigfoot be anything other than a giant monkey? Well, that's the earliest form of ghost hunting. Like if you read your parapsychological literature, one of the things you would do is you would spread talcum powder on the floor and wait for footprints to manifest. And ghosts seem to slam doors if ghosts exist. So the idea that these things are purely physical or purely immaterial seems to be something of a false dichotomy. So that's the first thing. And then if you look back through the history of ufology, you know, if you search for what I would call Prisca ufologia, sort of a play on the term Prisca theologia, a lot of the ways that we sort of engage with the phenomenon was through a spiritual lens. I mean, there's an argument to be made that a lot of the contactee movements were as strongly influenced by theosophy and spiritualism as anything else. So it seems like it's always sort of been pointing in this direction, and that the pivot to purely physical nuts and bolts, extraterrestrials and spacecraft is a more recent change in terms of the way that we've really interfaced with whatever this thing is. So having said all that, there is this curious idea of afterlife technology, which, again, I like to explore things and sort of do my best. And then sometimes I end up on the other side of it saying, I don't really know. But there has been a line of speculation that's been going through ufology for several decades. Once was much more popular than it is now. But the idea that that these could be craft that are literally built in the afterlife. And that idea feels really foreign to us as, you know, Westerners and whatnot. But if we sort of reposition the afterlife, whatever that may be, as another dimension, then this becomes a lot more palatable to the way that we think about the phenomenon, right? But if you look back into ancient cosmologies, you will find indications that the afterlife, whatever happens after we die, continues to progress and looks quite a bit like this world that we're in now. And that includes the potential for technological progress. In ancient Egypt, the Tuat was a place where you would go after you would die, and you would have to farm and worship and eat and sleep and all those things that we associate with life over here. Similarly, you could say the same thing about some ancient Chinese ideas about the afterlife that was basically a mirror version of the Chinese empire. So with that in mind, there has arisen a line of speculation that we are dealing with technology that is somehow built in on the other side and then manages to pierce the veil onto this side. Sir Victor Goddard, a rarely spoken about ufologist, played with this idea a little bit in like the, I believe the 1960s. You'll find vestiges of this in some of what Ray Palmer said that he shared with Kenneth Arnold. But, you know, interestingly enough, since we're on Dreamland, Whitley Strieber has reassessed what perhaps this implant that he has might be. And one of the things that has come up is that it was actually a device designed after the death of Konstantin Radovay, famous EVP electronic voice phenomena pioneer, designed after Radovay's death by Radovay to actually allow communication from the other side of the veil. And Whitley has his own reasons for coming to that conclusion, and I respect them. But what it is, it's just another piece of this puzzle that suggests that this concept of us just sort of floating off into the ether and living in this state of suspended animation where we all play harps and have wings is probably not accurate. Especially when you put that alongside some of those ancient beliefs that I mentioned.
I find that so fascinating. The physical aspect of all of this is always sort of, I think it makes UFOs such a good bridge into the paranormal, because it gives people who've grown up in that like materialist paradigm a place to, like a foothold, like a place to start.
Yeah.
But you quickly figure out that that's not all that there is. And I love this idea and the title of your book, Ecology of Souls, because, you know, we have this idea that like everything is more or less like us. We kind of normalize our assumptions about the world towards our own experience. But like over 95% or something of the universe is dark matter and dark energy. And by the way, we don't even know what that is. And so this idea that like maybe being physical in the way that we're physical is actually kind of rare in the big scheme of things, because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that could be the case.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the analog that always comes to mind for me is when people talk about technology, we have a tendency to think about silica and computer chips and metal and things like that. And I think that there are lots of different types of technologies, right? I think there might be technologies based on rock. I think that, quite frankly, some of the plant medicine that you find in indigenous use, like ayahuasca, that is a form of technology. It's not what we think of today as technology. But similarly, we might be confronting a comparable problem with when we talk about consciousness. You know, we think of consciousness as having to reside within some sort of ambulatory organism. But if you really start to engage with concepts like idealism or panpsychism, then it seems much more possible that we are just awash in consciousness. It's just that we can't recognize it or don't have the capacity to recognize it, or quite frankly, nowadays don't want to recognize it. But, you know, and I really resonate with some of those ideas because it does ascribe agency to places and to things like weather patterns and whatnot, which, again, I don't know if that's true or not, but it certainly results in a more enchanted worldview. And I think that's an important thing as a lot of our structures seem to crumble around us, to realize that the world has been and forever shall be enchanted. And that's something that we as human beings on this planet have every right to engage with and seek solace from, quite frankly.
Yeah, I completely agree. So when we're talking about UFO encounters or, you know, abduction encounters or, you know, things that we're more familiar with kind of in the UFO space, what is it about those experiences that people report that has structural similarity to things like near-death experiences and that sort of thing that gives you a reason to believe that these things are related?
Oh boy. Well, this will take us past the other 30-minute mark.
Easy questions only here.
No, well, so I mean, yeah, this is a thread that I wanted to pick up on and see how far we could take it. So I would supposedly I would say that the first thing is that transitive property, the connective tissue between the dead to fairies to UFOs. The second thing I would say is the way that UFO experiences have been compared to shamanic initiations all across the world. The work of the late Simon Harvey Wilson and the wonderful folklorist Eddie Bullard has really shown that there are quite a few similarities there, which makes perfect sense that Kenneth Ring would come along in 1992, I believe, and make comparisons between the UFO experience and near-death experiences, because in a lot of circumstances, shamanic initiations could be a walk to or past the threshold of death, and you come back with certain abilities and power. So this is all starting to become internally consistent in my mind. You know, I've heard some criticism of Ring's work. I recently saw, relatively recently saw someone saying, well, you know, if near-death experiences and UFO experiences are of the same character, then why don't we see more aliens in near-death experiences? And it's like, well, number one, we do. But number two, the more salient issue is the fact that we're so conditioned to view aliens as grays. And that's just not the case historically. It's not the case internationally. There's an argument to be made that not only do the occupants of UFOs often look more like average human beings, but they also take the form of beings of light. And both of those are staples in near-death experiences. So that really sort of betrays the bias that we have built into our assumptions about these phenomena. So you have all these connections. You have sort of the after effects that experiencers tend to have. You know, most famously, Dr. Jacques Vallée said that poltergeist manifestations after an experience were the rule rather than the exception. And that is entirely consistent with near-death experiences. It's entirely consistent with what we would assume from people who across different cultures would be called by a variety of names, but we might lump under the shamanic umbrella, right? So there are all these things that sort of add up to something about the experience, if not the same sort of experience, taking you to the same place, functioning by the same mechanism, something is there. And I feel relatively, you know, convinced of that. There are also these little bits and bobs that you can find if you look into the phenomenon. You know, the retrieval of inaccessible knowledge is part and parcel for all these experiences. Some of the sounds associated with them, buzzing sounds or the absence of sounds, the Oz effect. You'll find in the shamanic initiations, near-death experiences, UFO experiences, fairy encounters, a handful of cryptid encounters, although we won't go there today because maybe that's a little bit too far. You start to see these connective things, and that's where my heart really sings, is on this interdisciplinary, interconnected look at these phenomena. And then it gets even more profound when you start layering some of the symbolism onto the UFO phenomenon that we associate with an aspect of the way that we engage with death in generations past and don't really engage with now. Because, you know, the things that you can't talk about around the dinner table are, you know, sex, politics, death, and flying saucers, right? It's changing, but, there's this such potency in this concept of psychopomps, which were figures, deities, folk figures, sometimes natural phenomena, that were charged with leading human souls from this world into the afterlife. The Grim Reaper is an example of a folk psychopomp. Anubis or Hermes would be deities who are psychopomps. The sun and the moon were sometimes viewed as psychopomps. So that's an example of natural phenomena. Certain animals like dogs and horses and birds, including owls. if anybody is familiar with Mike Clellan's work, this should start to sound familiar and you should start to see where I'm going. And even Carl Jung himself in his essay on flying saucers, which literally might be the best book on UFOs, I think, in my humble opinion. Briefly in passing mentioned the idea that UFOs might be viewed as a sort of psychopomp. And sure enough, if you start to sort of dig, you get some basic similarities that I can't seem to shake. You have the idea of the psychopomp's boat. This is most familiarly seen in, Odin, who sometimes fulfilled psychopomp roles in Norse folklore, was sometimes a ferryman. Charon, the Greek ferryman over the river Styx. Like, the boat is a symbol of transporting from this world into the afterlife. And what is the UFO if not a vessel designed to take you somewhere else? Like, ufology is transportation obsessed, right? Where are they going? Where are they from? Where are they taking me? Why are they here? It's all about that juxtaposition between here and there. A lot of these psychopomp figures carry wands. There's an argument to be made amongst folklorists that the pole that ferrymen use is sort of a wand. But even, Hermes has his carrion. And there's some other folk figure, more obscure psychopomps that also carry wands. And that's sort of a staple that we see in a lot of UFO experiences, or at least in generations past. So I would humbly suggest that it's worth at least looking at the UFO phenomenon through the lens of the psychopomp, especially when you put it in the context of all the similarities between UFO experiences and these other contact modalities that have something to do with death, the near-death experience most explicitly. And that proved to be some very fertile ground to farm, let's say.
Yeah. What do you think about, okay, so I feel like there are a lot of people who struggle with the idea of incorporating, shamanic initiation and fairies and cryptids and all of these various things together. Even just integrating the kind of like progression in the more modern lore from the Space Brothers to the Greys and beyond, it does seem like this is a phenomenon that has a lot of similarity in structure and content, but like the manifestation of it or the interpretation of it or however we want to think about that ends up being very different. And I actually find, and I know you do, like that's the most interesting part of it. And it seems like that's not the end of the question. That's like the beginning of the question. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about like, what are the different theories that are out there? We don't have answers about why it is that these things, while they stay so consistent, also vary so much in their details across cultures and across history.
Well, I would agree with you that I sympathize. Part of what led me astray from the extraterrestrial hypothesis to begin with, before I was even really heavily invested in the topic of UFOs, was the multiplicity of manifestations that they take. And honestly, at the end of the day, I'm a person who can say, okay, I can believe that a race is visiting us, but when you get into, some UFO dictionaries having thousands of different races of aliens, that sort of complexity shifts me away from that being the answer. Whereas if you look at a phenomenon that takes many forms, a thing, the capital T thing, right? This thing seems to have a predisposition to change the way that it interacts with us, to change the way that it manifests. But there's so much deep tissue observation running across all these different contact modalities that it really suggests to me that we are dealing with a thing or the thing. Or again, at the very least, things that use similar methods and come from a similar place. That makes it a lot more palatable to my mind because it sort of simplifies and streamlines the phenomenon. Not that there aren't certain characteristics of each type of experience that are very different. You're less likely to be given food in a cryptid encounter than you are, a fairy encounter or even a UFO encounter. But there are these deeper tissue things that seem to link all these things. So that's where I've always come from. Now, as to why, that's a really good question. You know, I've had an evolution myself from taking a look at the UFO question and saying, hey, it looks a lot like the fairy stuff, to eventually being like, no, I'm pretty sure it's the same thing, because, you know, for me, implants were the thing that really sealed the deal for me, because there is an antecedent for that in the fairy blast, where the fairies would hit you with a gust of wind and put a foreign object under your skin that, whenever it was, you know, taken out, was always something mundane. I'm like, that's a really close comparison to the alien implant thing. So that was what tipped me over in that direction. But I don't think that the fairy pageantry was really replaced by UFO pageantry. I think the UFO pageantry was just added to the repertoire of masks that are used. And I would suspect sometime in the near future, that we might see something similar with the incorporation of AI imagery into the phenomenon. Like, oh, no longer is it, you know, aliens coming down to take us away. It's the AI bots are coming from their underground server base and they're coming to take us somewhere, you know, that sort of thing. But also, you know, the structures of these craft change and manifest. I think we just saw a sea change with that. Honestly, I've been predicting for a while that the Tic Tac footage was going to have people seeing drones in the sky, or associating the UFO phenomenon with drones more heavily. And I think the end of the last year's sort of paid that off. But as to why, that's a great question. I mean, I think that these things come in the form that is most readily accepted to us. So you will get certain populations that sympathize much more closely with the idea of elemental spirits or the dead or something. And that, I would suspect, might be what they tend to see, unless for some reason they need to be shocked out of that paradigm and see, you know, something that aligns more closely with the UAP phenomenon. You know, shades of Valet's control system right there. But I do think that there's some reciprocity, some sort of dialogue that happens between our culture and our expectations and the way that these things appear. You know, quick plug, I have a book that's coming out in April that is really taking a look at sort of the manner in which culture seems to loop back into the phenomenon, and then the phenomenon affects the culture, and we have the sort of Ouroboros of expectations going cycling between the two, called Fourth Wall Phantoms. That'll be out next month. But yeah, I think that probably has something to do with it. Except, as I alluded to, you get these examples where people see something that is so far out of their expectation that maybe the purpose is to sort of jostle people from their expectations. But that is why I think that we might start to see something that's a little bit more mechanistic, a little bit more terrestrial, as one of the masks that the phenomenon takes to basically sell its interventions here a little bit more strongly.
Yeah, I find that interplay so interesting, because it does seem like there's something that is, you know, in the classic Passport to Magonia style, like something that is putting on a mask of some kind, or trying to meet our expectations in some way. But our expectations also do seem to play there seems to be this kind of back and forth relationship with it that seems to suggest that, like, as much as we like to think of ourselves as purely physical, that whatever this other realm is, that, like, we have more than just a foot in it, that we seem to have some kind of a real connection to it.
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, I think one of the reasons that I've found altered states of consciousness so compelling as a possible vehicle for interacting with this other space or this other intelligence is because it's very similar to what people experience when going on a trip, you know, set and setting. Your expectations do seem to play a role in the way that those manifest. So why not in the way that these other phenomena manifest? And to your point about having a foot in that door, there was something that I said at the event in New York City back in 2023 that I've played with and finessed and incorporated. But I really do strongly suspect that ourselves and the UAP, the genuinely anomalous UAP, I should say, are mirror images of one another. I think that we are predominantly in the physical with an important component that is psychic. And I suspect that, you know, the UAP, UFOs, a lot of these phenomena are predominantly psychic with an important component that is in the physical. And I'm not saying that to downplay the physicality over the form of the phenomenon or the psychicality of ourselves. But what I am saying is that when I wake up, I generally think about the way my body feels, as opposed to, you know, anything in the psychic realm. So that's sort of like our home base of operation. And I think that to break through that barrier on both sides probably requires a strong investment of energy and time and resources. I just think that maybe UFOs are better at breaking that barrier than we are. But it is something that seems to be sort of a birthright of human beings to access this other space, which we are permitted to visit in. But when you come back to the space, you still have to sleep and eat and all those other things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that like broke my brain open early in my research and that I struggled with for a long time. I still struggle with it. But in speaking of Carl Jung, I know in one of his later letters in life, like not too long before he died, he said to someone that he had come to believe that UFOs were an archetype with a physical component. And I was like, what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, I've just spent a lot of time going back through Jung and really looking at the idea of his theory of the psychoid and of psychoid processes. That would be a better way to put it. And just archetypes and whatnot. And it's kind of like, I don't know, the way that I tend to view archetypes. I mean, if you want to employ a technical metaphor, which is all the rage these days, it's like the source code of the universe. But for me, it's more like those things that are unambiguous, but can't really pin down when they happen or exactly what they are. But you know, like I think of like, you know, the transition from late summer to early fall. Like there's like a moment when you're like, okay, now it's fall. Like I feel this deep in my bones. And you know, I think it's so. I think the idea of archetypes are so powerful, and I'm almost 100% sold on the concept because once you know what to look for, you really do start to see them not only across media, but like in yourself and in other people. You know, you're like, oh, I'm totally falling into this rut, this pattern. And so I think that it's less that the archetypes themselves are physicalized, but more that they, again, much like these phenomena we're discussing, they leave impacts on the physical reality. My favorite analogy that Jung employed for archetypes is that they're like a waterway that has over generations carved a deep furrow in the landscape. And, you know, sometimes that river runs dry, but once water returns, like it will find that pathway and continue down that channel. And I think what that analogy does is it allows for you to have these variations. You know, sometimes there are these little dead end tributaries or rivulets that break off in different directions. But it also allows, quite frankly, for the development of new archetypes in the future to sort of be carved into the landscape, if we're to sort of take that metaphor more literally. And I think that, you know, the UFO has played with a lot of different archetypal forms over the years. It has flowed down those waterways of shamanic initiation and of totality and the mandala and all those things that Jung was talking about, the boat to the other world that I mentioned earlier. But I think that, you know, it's just been, 70 plus years since the post-Arnold era? Like, we're kind of early, but I think it's on its way to sort of becoming its own archetype in and of itself. And I think that, you know, in future generations, we'll look at it in that light. But, yeah, I have come to greatly sympathize with Carl Jung's work. And there are some aspects of the way the archetypes manifest that have been quite confronting to me that I've found in my personal life and again in the lives of others.
Yeah, something that I find infinitely fascinating about this stuff is that there are these kind of archetypes that exist that are discoverable and people can interact with them and have very profound experiences with them without having been aware of that archetype. Like it's something that's so foreign to their own culture, to their own consciousness. You know, even thinking about somebody like Chris Bledsoe and, you know, that he encountered the lady who had a lot of sort of like archetypical connections to like Hathor or something like that. And so, and it makes you You know, I grew up with a father who was a Jungian psychiatrist. But I'd always kind of approached this idea of archetypes as something that was like very much just out, like in the non-physical, very hypothetical, kind of like, but that these things are discoverable by people who don't have access to that part of the culture is like very compelling to me.
Yeah, I think to sort of put a pin in what you're saying, or to sort of flesh it out a little bit more, your approach, which I think is the approach of a lot of people, was historically that the idea of archetypes says a lot about the way that we interpret phenomena as opposed to the actual manifestations themselves, right? It's like, oh, we're noticing this suite of trends, and, you know, maybe we're sort of, but yeah, you do run into people who have these interactions or have these outgrowths of cultures that they've never been invested in. Part of the reason I sort of slid into home base there on the last set of questions is because there's an example from my latest book, and I'm not trying to make this into a promo upcoming book, but it's just where my head is at lately. I have a friend whom I trust, who had a friend himself who was a sort of rough and tumble member of a motorcycle gang, and he lost an eye and became a born-again Christian, and really sort of turned his life around, because that can be a rough lifestyle. But he also liked wearing a wide-brimmed hat and carrying a staff, and like he had two blue healers that would sit on either side of him. He used to volunteer to do therapeutic massage at the VA. And it's like, so you sacrificed your eye for wisdom and you became a born-again Christian, but you're manifesting Odin. Like, you're 100%. And I've seen photos of the guy, and it's like, that's Odin. And, you know, my friend spoke to, not directly to him, but to his wife one time. It was like, have you ever noticed this and this and this and this? And it was just a blank, like, what are you talking about? And that to me is such a clear and unambiguous version of exactly what you're talking about. People who have no experience with this, who probably, if they were told they were manifesting this, would reject it. You know, someone as a born again Christian probably doesn't want to hear that they're manifesting the Norse Allfather. but it's there, and it's there for everyone to see. And you know, I've noticed that too in my own life. And I think that these things can have sort of a predictive power. I didn't realize how much I was being a trickster around the Thanksgiving table. Until I started reading George Hanson, I'm like, oh yeah, I am kind of like needling people with humor and like trying to stay neutral on all sides while like provoking people into fights and stuff. And I'm like, oh, you know, I was manifesting the trickster, and now I'm awash in the trickster as it manifests across the paranormal. And I think that these ideas are so powerful. They can be so powerful that if you really integrate them and you use them as sort of like, if you know what signs to look for, they can save your life. I mean, Fourth Wall Phantoms opens up with how archetypes and stories literally saved my life. That is, you know, I can sit here all day and talk about UFOs and Bigfoots and fairies and all this stuff, but I've never experienced anything like I have that, where like, not only did this thing manifest in my life, but I see how it did. And the reason I'm here today is because it did. That's another level of, I don't need to be convinced of that. And once you pass through that sort of inexperience like that, you start to sort of engage with archetypes, in my experience, in a more literal way than like, oh, this is just sort of a template that sometimes we graft onto people. No, the template is there, and we find our way to it. You know, not of our own volition, I would argue.
Yeah. You know, so my dad passed away about 20 years ago, and only in the last couple of years did I start looking into the etymology of his name during the pandemic, when all random rabbit holes opened up. But so his first name was Donn, D-O-N-N. And I was looking up the history of that name, and it's actually the name of a pre-Celtic god in mm-hmm. Ireland, who was like a god of death and like a psychopomp, actually.
Yep. Yeah.
And also he was often associated with like not just the dead, but with healing, and also with like music. And my dad was born on Halloween, which was like his, you know, Samhain was like his like high holy day, right? Mm-hmm. He died on St. Patrick's Day. He insisted on living in the Appalachians because he, although he had never been to Ireland, that was something he could do. Like he, that's like the same mountains, and he felt mm-hmm. like that was his home. He was also a doctor and a musician. And when I found all of that, I was just like, what? I mean, I know to a lot of people that sounds just like a lot of coincidences and like, so what? But to me, and also with like the role that my dad has taken on in my life as someone that I feel like is someone who guides me and helps me, it's, I just, I don't know. It sounded like what you're talking about with the guy with the Odin similarity, like these things just pop yeah. up.
Yeah, no, I completely resonate with that. And that's, you know, that's sort of what, I mean, that's sort of what psychopomps do as well, is like we place so much emphasis, appropriately, rightly so, we place so much emphasis on them escorting us into the afterlife, but they can sort of serve a general overall guiding function in our lives. But that's the sort of awakening that I think we could all benefit from, is that, and look, you know, maybe it's some sort of pareidolia of meaning, like maybe we're grafting on patterns, but like, I think it's a better way to live, you know, to find these patterns and to find some sort of meaning in the chaos, even if it is, you know, pictures in the clouds. I think that's that for me, that's a more fulfilling way to exist. And, once you realize that there are certain signposts and, trajectories, and dare it be said, like plot lines that have happened over and over again, that some sort of higher power seems to want us to sort of usher ourselves into, but that we've forgotten how to recognize over, you know, the past 700, 800 years. Only a few of us in more isolated pockets still recognize it. I think that can give you guidance in tough times, and you can say, okay, well, here's the fork in the road. You know, I'm in the belly of the whale. Am I going to wind up as whale crap, or am I going to fight my way out of it? And I think that I strongly suspect that the structure of reality, wants us to slay the dragon. It wants us to find our way out of Mirkwood. It wants us to participate in that sort of hero's journey, in our daily lives, in ways that might not be as triumphant as the old fairy tales, but are no less meaningful to us on a more personal level. And that's Fourth Wall Phantoms right there.
I can't wait to read it. I'm really excited about that, because I really resonate with that. Like my own journey into this world, I keep coming back to story, and as not just being important, but maybe being the whole thing. That there is something about the structure of our reality that is that not just that we project meaning onto it, but that it is somehow that like meaning and story is somehow the substrate of what we're interacting with.
Yeah. And I'll be completely frank with you. I'm kind of looking forward to having Fourth Wall Phantoms out in the world so I can retreat to firmer territory, because by the end of that process, I got into this place of like, I don't care if it's true or false. I don't care if this sighting was hoaxed or that was hoaxed. It's all, take it all in. There's something to be said for that. I think it's worth playing in those fields, but coming back to more grounded territory is where I want to spend my time. But yeah, as far as like an open-handed, a concept that you hold with an open hand as opposed to a closed hand, right? I think that there can be such poetry in that. And, you know, I think that it's part of what we're trying to really articulate when we go into the realm of synchronicities that are more astounding than we would allow any screenwriter, right? Or when we start to play with the idea of simulation theory, like it's all predicated on this idea that like, oh, that's too much of a coincidence. Oh, you know, it unfolded in this sort of dramatic way. I mean, the number of people who have said that post 2020, it seems like the final season of a failing TV show. Again, we're using these stories to sort of reflect what we're experiencing all around us. And if we can grasp the idea that we are embedded in story, then there's some sense of agency that we can take, especially if we embrace a concept that's at the core of this book. And again, I have no intention of steering us off of Ecology of Souls, but one of the core concepts in Fourth Wall Phantoms is this idea of metalepsis, which is the fourth wall break. where the character realizes that they're in the story. There's a hierarchical transition. I have found fewer concepts than this one that seem to encapsulate that sort of transcendental consciousness expanding experience of being an experiencer than the idea of metalepsis and breaking the fourth wall. And that's so empowering if it can be done in the right way. We are all part of a story, and maybe the only way out of the messes that we have ourselves in is to realize that, and to realize that we can reshape our reality in that sense.
Yeah, that's actually something that I know that there's a lot of angst in the world right now about things that are going on, and that anxiety is not without basis, clearly. But I also find a lot of hope in it, because it feels like there's a lot of chaos that ensues when we stop agreeing on the story. And I think that it's like as a culture and as a society, we have stopped. We no longer have a shared story. But in that space, it seems like as that story is falling apart, it does give us the hope I see is the opportunity to tell a new story.
When we lose our sense of story, and we sort of everything turns into a free for all. And there's not this sense of like, this is the way we should behave.
You know? Right.
But also how that sort of strips us of again, agency and our own power that we have to change. And I'm not asking for like everyone to decide that we're in a story and start like trying to, you know, go out and engage in Western ceremonial magic. Like, I'm just talking about like, dealing with your own shadow and like enacting change in your life, because that's one of the only ways that we can ever get out of the messes that we put ourselves into. And I suspect that I make a case for, in Fourth Wall Phantoms, this possibility that a lot of these experiences, maybe not all of them, but a lot of these experiences are all about calling us to realize this hierarchy that we are embedded in, and how much agency we have at this particular stratum. You know, again, Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey saved my life. There's another scholar who predates Campbell that I think probably has a greater bearing on that particular arc that I delve into. But I think that it's, you know, it's so difficult, Kelly, because like, I don't want to be the person who sits here and says, my work is really important, you know, read my book and buy my book. It's important. But like, I do feel like this particular book that's coming up is important because it has bearing on stuff besides UAP and UFOs. And as much as I love UAP and UFOs and cryptids and spooky stuff, you know, being kind to each other, making a better world for ourselves and for our children and for future generations, like that's really the most important thing, I think, in this reality. And so I think there might be the hint of a blueprint for that. So.
Yeah. And I think that's where the work leads, right? Like, it's like UFOs are the portal in. But I was just joking with Jay that I'm like ready to move out of UFO town and settle down in the paranormal suburbs. Cause
well, it's that old Ami Michel quote, right? Like, you know, the flying saucers are initiation. You start looking at reports of things in the sky and end up reading Arab mystics is what I believe he said, something to that effect. And like, yeah, and that's sometimes I wonder if that's not the point of it, right? Is to take you into places and to kindle within you interest in things that you wouldn't have any interest in otherwise. You know, I wouldn't have ever read about some of these philosophies of mind or some of these religious or spiritual traditions if my journey hadn't taken me through UFO land, right? And I think that's one way that you can view this as an alchemical process to sort of transform yourself into a more thoughtful person. Yeah, I mean, the paranormal suburbs are where it's at, in my opinion. You know, you know, as I've said before, like I will entertain the possibility that we've been visited and may still be visited. But I think a lot of these experiences, as you alluded to in Cosmos, are about human potential and about these sort of deeper questions that are not about propulsion systems and anti-gravity and stuff. I mean, that's just that to me that I'm not trying to disparage anyone who finds those ideas really compelling, but to me, they feel like dead ends that end in, you know, military contracts or something. Like that's not what my day-to-day experience on planet Earth wants to be like. I want to think about these bigger questions. And I think the paranormal field writ large has less of a problem with engaging with these metaphysical topics than some sectors of the UFO community, which is why sometimes I feel like a pariah in the UFO community. But
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, but speaking of story, and I can't wait to read this book, by the way. I feel like I'm the one who keeps steering the conversation back there, because I love this idea of how story relates to all of this. Is that in some ways, like, we talk about afterlife technology as something kind of, we talked about it as something sort of like potentially physical, but in some ways it feels like story is a kind of technology that transcends the physical, that there is like that the hero's journey itself is in some ways a technology that, if you engage with it, can, as you were saying, kind of like transform people.
I mean, yeah, if you expand that idea of technology as just a way to improve or guide life, or as a means to an end, then yeah, I would agree with that. And as far as what story is or what it represents, like, the jury is still out. You know, narratologists have debated this, and I've found some compelling ideas here and there, one of which might be, it's the story is the opportunity to download experience without having to go through the hardship of experience. I find that to be really compelling. And in that sense, it would very much be sort of a technology. And, you know, if you do look at something that are these sort of narrative archetypal beats, they do allow you to sort of take stock of your situation and say, oh, this is what I've been doing. I have been falling into these ruts. What are the positive outgrowths of this? You know, because, there are plenty of Greek tragedies. Do I want to be a Greek tragedy, or do I want to have my life resemble something a little bit more, you know, personally heroic? And so, yeah, in that sense, I do think you're right. It could be viewed as a form of technology. And honestly, there are some people who think that it might be, in that sense, one of the first technologies. There are indications that it might predate language, you know, and depending on your assessment of petroglyphs and what they might represent too. So, yeah.
Yeah, so before I did this work, I used to work in marketing, and there have been plenty of people who've been suspicious of me just because of that. And I will actually say that that is fair, because, you know, part of the reason, whether it had been UFOs or something else, I was going to get out of marketing because I had sort of realized that marketing was psychology for sociopaths, basically.
I mean, yeah, I've served as the public affairs director of a school of music, so I'm kind of in the same boat a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. And like, and one of the most effective tools that I found near the end of my marketing career, but then also sort of hastened my exit, was recognizing that using the hero's journey while creating customer journeys, like very specifically using that and training teams to do so, made extraordinarily powerful and effective marketing campaigns. But then I also felt the darkness of that, because it was like stripping out everything that's good and use from that process and transformative about that process and using it to sell widgets. And
yeah,
but that was something that made me start to think of it as a technology, because it's literally just a thing that if you put these certain things in this certain order, it has an impact on the human mind, and it drives people not just to change how they think, but to do things that they wouldn't have otherwise done. You know, not like in a necessarily totally nefarious way, but like to buy, you know, an Instagram ad does that, you know?
Well, I mean, to a certain degree, language writ large is the same way, right? I mean, you know, it's a, language is a weapon that can enslave or liberate. It's just a matter of who's holding the trigger, you know? So yeah, I completely agree with that. And the idea of also like moving the results of the call to action into people's lives. Like, people don't want your toothpaste. They want better teeth. Like, you know, right. they want their teeth to be healthy, and sort of realizing it and sort of looking at it from that angle. And then once you start to realize that, you know, I'm trying to remember the stats from journalism school, but something like 90% of the population thinks that advertisements don't work on them. And it actually works on the 90%, you know? So what I would ask is, if we treated these things, these ideas, these archetypes, these motifs, of which I would lump the hero's journey into, as more real than, you know, a storytelling contrivance, what would that do to our reality? What would that do to our worldview? You know, how would that manifest in your life, as opposed to being weaponized or rehashed endlessly across the Hollywood landscape as it has been. You know, what happens when you really seriously engage with that is like, oh no, this is actually the way that the universe works, that reality works. And what is that calling me to do? I think that could have some pretty profound implications, for all of us.
Yeah. It strikes me, and it's really struck me over the last few years, the extent to which we consume stories as opposed to living stories in our culture is kind of like taken everybody out of, but that there's that agency that you're talking about, like, comes alive for you to the extent that synchronicities happen and, you know, things that can feel quite magical happen. And the only thing you have to do to activate that in your life is to just literally become the main character again.
Yeah. That's something that I experienced in my own personal journey. The moment in my life when I most fully engaged with this concept was also the time period when I had the most profound mind-blowing synchronicities happen and just general strange ephemera in my life. Like, you know, nothing revelatory, but like, why was there a helicopter that I never saw hovering over my house, you know, that I could hear at this odd time of night, you know, just little things like that, that really did suggest, like, you know, when you look at this, I mean, you know, when you look at this thing looks back at you as sort of been an old chestnut, Keel's reflective factor. But I really think that what that is this act of metalepsis, this act of breaking that fourth wall and saying, oh, this is something that I'm embedded in, that may have strong tendencies, but doesn't really have laws the way that I've been told. And I think that is just, it's a hard place to be, in some ways, and it's a hard place to live that in your daily life as you go make yourself a sandwich and then go to the bathroom and whatnot. But applied to these broader arcs, is something that I've found is very useful, even if I don't apply it as often or as consistently as I should.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this feels like a great place to end this first hour of the show. It flew by. This has been so much fun. I'm glad Josh and I are going to continue talking for about another half hour, if on the member side of the podcast. If you are not a member of the podcast, you can sign up at unknowncountry.com to hear the rest of this conversation. And Josh, before we go and say goodbye to the public-facing part of the podcast, can you just tell people where they can find you and when's your new book coming out? Because I also want to circle that on my calendar.
All right. I will try to compress this as much as possible. You can find me online at joshuacutchin.com, joshuacutchin.com. The new book that's coming out is Fourth Wall Phantoms. It'll be coming out in April. I'm actually doing a countdown on my social media to the trailer and the cover reveal and the release date. I mean, I'll just say it here. The release date is April 13th, but
nice.
You haven't seen the cover yet. And I love the cover so much. So visit my social media for that. I'm pretty easy to find in that regard. And I'll be doing two events in August, one in Kansas City on August 2nd, 2025. That's Paracon Kansas City. And another event at the end of the month, the 30th through the 31st, I will be at the Cape Girardeau Paranormal Convention in Missouri. So would love to see some people there.
Oh, amazing. Well, thank you so much, Josh.
It's been an absolute blast. And you're right. It flew by.
So we've been talking a lot about kind of this interplay between the physical and the non-physical and, you know, this life and the afterlife. One of the things that I find really interesting structurally about these different kinds of experiences that sort of cross both boundaries is, you know, we talked a little bit about how they manifest in ways that are similar, but they're also, especially with these sort of more subjective experiences that are harder to nail down, a lot of the evidence that we have afterwards that they even happened is in the person themselves. It's in how, not just what they remember, but how these experiences change them. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of the similarities between something like a UFO encounter or a near-death experience or, you know, one of these other kinds of strange experiences that people can have and how it changes people in general and how they see the world.
Right. And since this is where our heads have been,
right.
You know, that's the definition of a character, right? Like, do they change, you know, do they integrate what they learned? I mean, it is something that you see across a lot of these different contact modalities, for lack of a better term. Sometimes it's as simple as just realizing that there is something beyond what we've been told exists. You know, it really is leaning into that personal experience and being like, well, you know, I'm told that we're wet robots and that we die and nothing happens. But like, no, I experienced this thing that is literally impossible and there's no way to fit it into any of these sort of paradigms. And that sort of sets people off on the journey. But, you know, I think that's probably most profound in the UFO contact experience and in the near-death experience. But similar argument could be made for something seemingly as unrelated as cryptid experiences. I mean, you know, John Keel noted that people's lives were often thrown into turmoil in the wake of these experiences, to the extent that he speculated, you know, sort of a monster curse. He didn't use the word cryptid too much. He used the word monster. But, you know, the manner in which people's lives can shift in those contexts, you know, you'll have someone who's been a hunter for years. And if their experience was negative and or they incorporated it in sort of a terrifying way, they might never go back into the woods. Like, that happens a lot. Tragically, there's a tendency for some people to slip into depression or substance abuse. Actually, one of the things that people don't talk about after near-death experiences is that even after positive NDEs, a lot of people will fall into this depressive state where they feel like they should have stayed there, or they can't wait to be back there. And only after they push through it and they integrate that, you know, the implications for that experience, do they actually find what we most often associate with the after effects of these experiences, which are renewed outlooks on life, not sweating the small things, an increased sense of mission or obligation to the other people on the planet, intense environmental concerns, sometimes extending to, you know, especially in the earlier literature, some UFO experiencers taking up vegetarianism or veganism, this idea that, you know, life is life in all its forms is precious. Interestingly enough, I mean, if you look at something like the Free Foundation studies, which I believe had over 4,200 respondents, that data seemed to suggest that as interest in spirituality and some of these other positive things increased, and interest in organized religion decreased, which I think has some profound implications. It's a tough thing to talk about, right? Because, you know, just as I alluded to, like, there are these negative experiences that people have. There are these terrifying experiences that people have. And it's got to be hard to listen to some knucklehead like me, you know, say that, you know, oh, this is a wonderful positive experience. It's, you know, when you've just been taken against your consent and had things done to you against your consent, or, you know, literally feared for your life when you encountered something in the woods, right? So I guess what I'm sort of pointing at is that part of the reason that I chose the title Ecology of Souls for ecology is because an ecology suggests that there are good things out there and bad things out there and things in between out there and things that don't even have a concept of good or bad. I mean, like, you know, the example I always use is like your interests might not be aligned with a shark or a tornado, but it doesn't mean it's evil. It's just doing its, you know, a shark's gonna shark, a tornado's gonna tornado, right? So that's part of the context that I think people have to come to with this. But the other thing is, you know, something that I've learned in my involvement in the recovery community too, is that like the people who really get it and get it right, not saying that I'm one of them. I'm blessed to have been 4.5 years sober myself, but the people who get it and get it right are the ones who like had a bad rock bottom and would not trade that for, you know, all the riches in the world, because it was against that backdrop that they were able to juxtapose the lives that they wanted and the lessons that they learned. So again, this idea that that everything has to be positive, or that something negative can't have positive fallout, really, I think it would be healthier for us to acknowledge the fact that good things can come from bad things. And that's, you know, one of my problems as a Christian that I see with the way that Christianity is treated a lot, you know, stuff like prosperity gospel and whatnot, where it's like, you know, if you're, you know, if you're a follower of Christ, everything's going to be okay. No, that's not really what the church has ever been about. And if you read, a lot of religious texts accurately, it's very clear that, there is pain and suffering. It's just a matter of what you do with that and where you place your, priorities. And yes, you should alleviate pain and suffering where you see it. You should try to avoid it and make those around you, happy and safe and healthy and all these things. But at the end of the day, if you truly believe in transcendence, this is probably whatever happens in this life is probably minuscule compared to the greatness of this other hierarchical reality that we're embedded within.
Yeah, I think what you're saying really speaks to something that, I mean, I think anyone in the community has seen, where somebody will have some sort of a transcendent experience and have this recognition of the things that we're talking about, like how story is such an integral part of our lives and that we have some sort of ability, like co-creative ability with regard to our reality. And then some people take it to this place where they think that if they just never, where people will think that if they just never have a bad thought, that if they just eliminate negative thoughts and they only think good thoughts, that that is going to eliminate any kind of negative externality in their life. And it's like there's a place where you can go with it that's a little too far. And I think that can set people up for some pretty massive disappointments.
Yeah, I mean, and that's always sort of the knife's edge that you have to walk, is because if you start talking about, outlook and positivity and co-creating your lives, you quickly wind up in this stance of, cancer victims bringing it about themselves through some sort of negative intention or thought. And that's not at all what I should ever be interpreted as saying. As someone who is diagnosed obsessive compulsive, I there have been times in my life where I struggled with that idea, even before I was into the occultism or, the paranormal, whatever. The idea that, my negative thoughts were going to somehow manifest some sort of fallout in the real world was something that was very, clear and present for me. I think really what it turns out, an idea that I've been playing with, is that it's more about just sort of a positioning. And, if what we were alluding to on the earlier part of our conversation about set and setting somehow playing a role in these, extraordinary encounters, and these extraordinary encounters sometimes having a certain spontaneity, like you can't schedule them, it's best to maintain an attitude of positivity to ensure that when you brush up against the divine, against the supernatural, whatever this thing is, that you are in a position that is more likely to be receptive and more likely to project, I think, some of this positivity to ensure that you don't get the most terrifying version of it. So in other words, it's not like an expunging of all bad thoughts. It's more about on the whole, I try to orient myself towards a more positive outlook. I think that's at least where I've settled on things.
Yeah. It feels like since we're kind of at this intersection of talking about death and story and all of this and meaning, that we should talk about the role that ritual plays in all of this, because we definitely, I think, in fact, some of the earliest kind of signs of humans becoming something other than our hominid ancestors, or I guess even probably before that, is that the date on this keeps getting pushed back and back. But some of the earliest kind of like human behaviors that we can identify are seemingly rituals around death and the afterlife and what we do with the dead. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about like what you think about that connection.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that you're confronted with, is that, one of the first things that we did, if Göbekli Tepe is any indication, one of the first things that we did as a species after securing our basic human needs is that we built religious sites. Like, so that was the first thing that we did. And now you can go back to some of the signifiers that they found among Neanderthal remains, that ritual was an important part of their lives. And I think that ritual in its most sort of distilled form is a type of drama, right? And drama is a story. Even if there's no story, like, there there's the idea there's a veneer of artificiality that is being enacted in the real world with the hopes of like schlepping along reality with it. Like, so you're playing and you're sort of pulling something into it. I think it's one of the earliest human art is one of the most, one of the earliest human impulses. And with that comes ritual, which, you know, I've heard it argued that OCD is a type of ritual thinking in and of itself. You know, when I go back and check the oven and like slap myself on the wrist every time, like it's a form of ritual, right? This is why over the years I've grown to appreciate the occultists more and more. Don't get me wrong. There's some occultists where I'm like, okay, just step back into reality a little bit more. But you know, the way that I've said it is that, you know, when I was in college, I was sort of, disheartened because the smartest people in the room were the atheists. I'm like, oh wow, what does that say about, you know, what I'm doing with my life? But as I've grown, as I've come into, the paranormal suburbs, as you alluded to,
okay,
I've found that the occultists are oftentimes the smartest people in the room, in the sense that they've read a lot of philosophy and sometimes science and all these things that they agree with and that they disagree with too. And yet they've still landed on this idea that reality is, again, in a sense, co-created. And with that, I can't help but see a lot of ceremonial magic as theater, you know, and the idea that you are performing something to entice out genuine phenomenon. Iamblichus talks about the fact that there are certain classes of spirits that are unable to distinguish fact from fiction. And that seems to be what's going on when you're doing a ceremony that is ritualized, is you're speaking lines and you're in a costume and you're play acting and you're trying to convince these forces beyond us that you are who you say you are and you have the authority that you say, especially in something like Solomonic magic, which interestingly enough really aligns closely with the work of John Sabal, a parapsychologist who's taken up this this technique of reenacting events at haunted sites in period accurate clothing with period accurate language, doing things, saying things that would have been said at the time period that they're trying to evoke. And actually, according to him, having a better track record of capturing genuinely anomalous phenomena when engaged in that sort of drama or play acting. And I think that's the exact same thing that we're seeing with ceremonial magic and probably, you know, ritual writ large.
Yeah, I grew up Catholic, and then I spent most of my adult life as an atheist, mm-hmm. Before I got into this world. And I, very early on, like one of the first questions I had, like I was that I knew that the occult had a lot to do with all of this, but I just couldn't quite figure out what that was. And growing up the way I did, I didn't have a really strong, I had like no real idea of what the occult actually was. Mm-hmm. And then when I started learning about it, I realized that it was everywhere. I mean, including in the Catholic mass, like the day that I was like, oh, that's ceremonial magic, like blew my mind, because that was just not the paradigm that I existed in. But everything from that to, you know, really high achieving, like championship sports teams and that sort of thing, like ritual just is a part. It's such mm-hmm. a human thing, and it's so much a part of our lives, whether we identify it as that or not.
Yeah, I was driving back from an out-of-town gig earlier this month, and I was having a conversation with someone, and I just said, like, everything has an occult angle. Like, everything has an occult angle. Like, and, you know, it's something as simple as, you know, the superstitions that we don't even that we're not even consciously aware of, like little tics that we might have before we take the stage or something. I often say that I know just enough about the occult to be dangerous. Like, I'm not a practicing occultist. Like, I've dabbled with sigils and that's about it. But you know, I do know enough people that that I have every reason to believe obtain the results that they do. And I think that it's not necessarily about all the trappings that come with it, you know, the particular discipline or school of thought or school of magic. It's more about the fact that they've found something that facilitates this more than human part of themselves to engage with that. You know, they've found something that works for them to, that works as a launching pad to access this thing that I think we all have. You know, I do think that psychic powers are something that is a bit like drawing or something, or genuine, or artistry in general. Like, some people are predisposed to it and some people can train and work and, you know, get better at it. But you know, I think that it's something that we all have, and it's just a matter of, what way you're going to get there.
So what do you make of the fact that, because I find this fascinating, that so many of kind of the founders of what we think of as the of the field of ufology, people who are still involved in all of these things now, are, a lot of them are, they're either occultists or they're in sort of that kind of vein, like a mystery school, some sort of, you know, even Catholic, like Rosicrucianism, Catholicism, right, is like overly represented, which is certainly one of the more occult sects of Christianity, if you, you know, comparatively. Mm-hmm. Like, and they seem to be very interested in things like near-death experiences and the soul, almost to almost more. And I would actually argue more than they are actually interested in UFOs. And UFOs are almost this kind of like cover or catch-all or something to, for what they're really right. interested in. Like, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I said at one point in, Ecology of Souls, I said, like, which would upend your understanding of reality more? That reality looks like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, or that reality looks like the Iliad? Like, which is weirder to you? And I know my answer. Like, you know, space people is just more people, right? The idea that there are forces like warring in the heavens that are manipulating us, and that we live in some sort of magical reality where, you know, it that can really shift under our feet, that's a lot weirder to me than space scientists, right? And you're right. There is this sort of through line where it's almost as if there is an exoteric version of some more popular UFO movements and an esoteric version, and a version that's discussed like when you're actually in person after the lectures and you're at the bar. Okay. Like, these are the topics that come up. And you know, I'm not always sure what to make of it. You know, it is encouraging for someone like me who sometimes gets a lot of heat for not buying into the extraterrestrial hypothesis and for, you know, having historically been critical of some of these movements. I think what it really amounts to is that, and this isn't implying any sort of, structured agenda or structured plan, but what I think it really amounts to is the fact that, like, a lot of people, if we were to generalize the populations of the world, or especially speaking from my own experience, the American population, are unable to engage with those concepts right away. Right. You know, organized religion still plays a role. To this day, somehow these ideas are still called woo. And that sort of entraining that we've experienced has to be broken bit by bit. And this is where, like, I will continue to serve myself up heaping helpings of crow and eat all the crow in the world, because I was so critical of the disclosure movement for a long time. Until I think in the past around late 2022, you know, 2023 was when I finally realized that the goal from my perspective, I had gotten wrong. I thought that someone was going to come out and you were going to have an authority figure say, this is Ambassador Zarthlax from Zebel Ganubi, and this is, they've been here for a while, and, you know, and that sort of thing. And especially now, like, when no matter who the world leader is, like, half of their population is not going to believe them. Like, it's just, right, just the default setting that we've arrived at nowadays. I thought that was a fool's errand. But what I really realized was that the goal was probably something much more akin to the way that the conversation has moved in regards to the Kennedy assassination, where, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there was a significant amount of people who still bought into the official narrative. But nowadays it's hard to find people who buy into the official narrative. And I think that was where I had it wrong, is that the goal of disclosure was really just to put that crack in the dam, to just sort of chip that artifice away a little bit, to get people to arrive at the place where they say, well, I don't know what's going on with the UAP question, but something is happening. There's something strange. Something doesn't add up. And in that sense, this current disclosure season, because it does come and go in seasons, this current disclosure season has been a resounding success. And so I know when to acknowledge that I've been wrong in that regard. But I do think that if there is an end game or disclosure, that it is this human potential angle, that it is the metaphysics. And it's just that it takes a while to get, you can't just jump right into that right away, I don't think. With hindsight and perspective and hopefully a dash of humility, that's the way that I've interpreted these current moves. It is encouraging to see, people interested in and discussing some of these more profound topics rather than, again, propulsion systems and anti-gravity and what planet they come from, which again, may play a part in this phenomenon in a way that I don't think any of us have grasped, that it is aliens, but it's really weird aliens, I think still is a possibility that remains on the table. But I think that the end goal, if full disclosure is ever achieved, will probably look a lot more like some sort of revelatory spiritual disclosure than it does necessarily a star chart of where these people are coming from.
Yeah. I really see that in the, like, really just in the last few months, even, like, things have changed so much kind of in UFO
Ionics,
world.
Yeah. People are talking about psi and stuff. And yeah.
Yeah. And also just like people's thinking about it. Like, I think that, you know, obviously there are people who've been kind of just came into this since 2017. I think there's a much even larger wave that came in around, you know, between kind of 2020 and the Grush hearing and, and beyond. And even those, that kind of later wave of people, I'm starting to really see the sentiment change rapidly, like really quickly, just in the last few months, towards kind of recognizing what you're talking about, that the disclosure movement isn't what they thought it was, but like neither is the phenomenon, and that they're ready to kind of have a deeper conversation. So as somebody who's sort of been delving into that deeper end of the pool in your research for a long time, like what advice would you have for people who are kind of just at that precipice in terms of where they should or where they could address, maybe a strong word, where they could direct their attention and what does that path look like once you sort of have that realization?
I mean, for me, it's always about, I do see a lot of people enter into this field and automatically like start shutting down possibilities, right? And that doesn't mean that every hypothesis carries equal weight, but I would encourage everyone to like engage with as many as they can, even stuff that they deliberately don't agree with. Like that's so much, so as I sort of alluded to earlier, like, you know, a lot of what I do is being like, I don't want to talk about UFOs and the dead. I don't want to talk about, you know, Donald Duck walking out of someone's closet like I do in Fourth Wall Phantoms. Like, I don't like that. I don't want to talk about that. I don't know what to do with it. It sounds like, you know, BS, and just go along. But to force yourself to be like, okay, well, let's just say maybe this is what's going on. Is there any value in there? Is there any consistency in there? Is there any insight to be gained from that? And 9 times out of 10, I've found that even with the stuff that I end up rejecting, there is some sort of bit of wisdom that I've learned along the way, or it's challenged me to think about these phenomena in a different way or something like that. So that would be my bit of advice, is to, you know, engage with the idea of afterlife technology, engage with the idea of Sir Trevor James Constable's sky critters, engage with the idea of ultra-terrestrials and crypto-terrestrials and the fairy folklore, and, you know, engage with the idea of blue avians and, you know, galactic federations and stuff. Like, have a big basket in your head that says interesting if true. And have your true basket be really small and your false basket be really small. And you know what? If you're an experiencer, maybe your true basket's a little bit bigger because you realize what you have experienced, right? You have a level of gnosis that I don't have, right? But have that basket that says interesting if true be really big. And I think the more that you put in that basket, the more you'll start to be able to revisit it and start sifting through it and be like, well, this part sounds kind of right. And this kind of connects to that, but the interpretation is wrong, but the connection is there. And then you'll sort of form your own perspective on the phenomenon. And that's what I've done. And again, to go places that you just don't feel comfortable. Like if you were to ask me, if we'd have had this conversation 8 years ago, 10 years ago, and you'd ask me about how much of this phenomenon I think comes from the witness or is self-generated, not in terms of a hallucination or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there's some part of ourselves that we are interacting with exteriorized, literally, in the literal sense. If you were to ask me that question, you know, a decade ago, I'd have been like, I don't like that idea. But, you know, over time, like engaging with these ideas and like sitting my inner 10-year-old down and saying, Josh, just, you know, I know you want there to be another thing outside of us, but just entertain this possibility. I've come around on that to a significant degree. You know, while not landing on any sense of certainty, that's the other thing that I would advise too, is to avoid the certainty fetish, as my mentor, Greg Bishop, calls it. There's no need to put a pin in this thing. You know, we're all sort of trying to feel around. And the moment that you decide what it is, number one, it'll probably shoot out of your grasp, like when you squeeze a watermelon seed and it just, you know, you can't pick it up. Number one, it'll give you some conflicting data, right? If you decide what it is. But number two, you've also shut yourself out to what it might be and profound developments in the future. And that's part of where what I'm trying to explain when I talk about my reassessment of the disclosure community, is that like I was guilty of doing that myself, and I've tried to reevaluate it and pivot and, you know, find a way to make everything play together. So that would be my advice.
Well, I love that advice, and I think it's a wonderful place to end our conversation. Josh, thank you so much. This has been so much fun. I feel like I could talk to you for another 3 hours. So hopefully we'll get the chance to do it again soon.
It's been an absolute blast. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.